When they had drunk until their bellies ached, they scooped the water over their heads and let it soak their clothing, and they laughed weakly with the joy of it. A mile beyond the waterhole, they reached the line at which the wind had changed and held the fire, driving it back upon itself. They left behind them the devastation of black ash and smouldering stumps, and camped that night amongst the confusion of withered dead branches, where the logging gangs had wrought almost as much destruction as the flames had done. For the first time since the fire, Alfonso rigged the radio aerial, and they gathered round the set and listened for General China's taunts and threats. They all stiffened instinctively as they recognized his voice. But he was talking in Shangani, and they could hear the sound of the helicopter's engines in the background. His transmissions were terse and enigmatic, and the replies from his subordinates were equally abrupt and businesslike. "What do you think he's up to?" Sean asked Alfonso. And the Shangani shook his head. "It sounds like he is moving troops into fresh positions." But there was no conviction in his tone. "He hasn't given up," Sean said. "He may have lost our spoor in the burn, but I don't think he has given up."
"No," Alfonso agreed. "I know him well. He has not given up. He will follow us all the way. General China is a man who hates very well. He will not let us go."
"We're in Frelimo held territory now. Do you think he will follow us in here?" Alfonso shrugged.
"He has the Henshaw. He does not have to worry too much about Frelimo. I think he will follow us wherever we go."
General China made his last transmission, and it was obvious he was arranging for refueling. He had changed to Portuguese, and the reply seemed to be from a ground engineer in the same language. Alfonso translated. "The porters have arrived. We now have reserves of 2,000 litres. China's voice. "What about the spare booster pump?"
"It's here, my general," the engineer again. "I can change it tonight."
"We must be airworthy again by first light tomorrow."
"I will have it ready by then, I guarantee it, General."
"Very well. I'll be landing in a few minutes. Be ready to begin work immediately," China ordered, and then signed off.
They listened for another 10 minutes until it was fully dark, but there were no further transmissions, and Alfonso reached across to turn off the radio. On an impulse, Sean prevented him doing so, and instead switched frequencies. Almost at once he picked up the South African military traffic. It was much stronger now. They were much closer to the border on the Limpopo River. And to Sean, the sound of Afrikaans was a comfort and a promise. After a few minutes, Sean sighed and switched off the set.
"Alfonso, you take the first sentry. Go," he ordered.
With the threat of aerial surveillance reduced, Sean decided to resume daylight travel, and every mile they covered towards the south, the signs left by the logging gangs were fresher and more numerous. On the third day after the fire, Matatu led them on a wide detour. The hardwood stumps had been cut very recently, and they were still weeping sap. The leaves on the discarded branches piled in tall windrows had not dried out, and they were still green and pliant. Matatu cautioned them to silence, and as they trudged on between the piled rows of trash, they heard, not far off, the whine of chainsaws and the doleful work chant of the labour gangs. The forest around them was full of human activity, and the soft soil carried the prints of thousands of bare feet and the skid marks of heavy logs being dragged and manhandled towards the rough logging roads. However, so skillfully did Matatu shepherd them through the torn and despoiled forests that it wasn't until the fourth day of travel that they actually caught sight of any other human beings. Leaving the others to eat and rest well concealed under a shaggy pile of newly cut branches, Sean and Matatu sneaked forward to the edge of a natural open glade in the forest, and through the binoculars Sean lay and watched the Frelimo logging gangs at work on the far side of the opening. Hundreds of black men and women, some of them no more than children, were toiling in teams, supervised by guards in Frelimo camouflage battle dress. The guards all carried AK rifles slung on their shoulders,
but they wielded the long hippo-hide whips, the savage African jambok, which they plied to the naked backs and legs of their charges. The snap of the lash on bare flesh and the agonized yelps carried across 500 yards of open ground to where Sean and Matatu lay. The labour gangs were piling the roughly trimmed logs into tall, pyramid-shaped stacks, half of them straining and heaving on the heavy ropes, while the others pushed against the huge timber baulks from the lower side. The guards urged them to greater effort, calling out the verses of the work chant to which the gangs responded with a deep, melancholy chorus and a concerted heave on the heavy manila ropes. While Sean watched through his binoculars, one of the huge logs was laboriously hoisted towards the pinnacle of the stack, but before it could be rolled securely into place, one of the ropes parted, and the log slewed sideways and went bouncing and rumbling down the side of the pyramid. Wailing with terror, the labour gang broke and fled before it, but some of the weaker ones were not fast enough, and the log steamrolled over them. Sean heard their shrill shrieks snuffed out, and the crackle of their bones like dried twigs being fed through a clothes mangle. It was too much even for a soldier's hardened stomach, and he touched Matatu's shoulder and they crept away, back to where they had left the others. That afternoon they passed close to the labour camps, a vast collection of primitive lean-to huts that stank of wood smoke, open latrines and human misery. "The cheapest African commodity these days is black flesh," Sean told Claudia grimly. "If you told people back home about this, they just simply wouldn't understand what you were talking about. It's just so contrary to our own experience," said Claudia. At this time of day, the camps were almost deserted. All the able-bodied were at work in the forest, and only the sick and the dying lay under the crude open shelters. Sean sent Matatu into the camp to scavenge, and he must have found one of the field kitchens and eluded the cooks. He returned with a half sack of uncooked maize meal slung over his shoulder. They ate handfuls of maize porridge that evening, huddled round the radio, listening to General China's voice on the Renamo command frequency. Once again, after General China had made his last transmission at nightfall, Sean switched to the South African military frequency and listened for almost half an hour, learning the voices and call signs of the various units within range. At last, he felt he had identified the South African border headquarters. It was using the call sign Kudu, that beautiful spiral-horned antelope of the bushveld. Sean waited patiently for a lull in the military traffic, and then he keyed the microphone and spoke in Afrikaans. "Kudu? This is Mossy. This is a storm sending. Do you read me, Kudu? This is Mossy." A storm sending was the call for a top priority message. It was the radio procedure that they'd used back in the days of the Rhodesian Bush War. He hoped that the South African commander's military experience went back that far. Mossy, in Afrikaans, was a sparrow, and had been Sean's call sign in those far-off days. A long silence followed Sean's transmission, in which the static echoed in the void of the stratosphere, and Sean thought that his call had been lost. He lifted the microphone to call again, just as the radio came to life. "Station calling Kudu," said a voice, heavy with suspicion. "Say again your call sign."
"Kudu, this is Mossy. I repeat, Mossy, Mike Oscar Sierra, Sierra India Echo. I request a relay to General De La Rey, the Deputy Minister of Law and Order."
Lothar De La Rey had been Sean's control back in the 70s. Since then he had risen to high political office. Kudu would surely know who he was and hesitate to refuse a request for relay to such a source. It was clear that Kudu must be thinking the same thoughts, but taking longer to reach a decision. At last he called again.
"Mossy, stand by. We are relaying you to De La Rey."
Almost an hour later, long after dark, Kudu called again.
"Mossy, this is Kudu. De La Rey is unobtainable."
"Kudu,
This is life and death. I will call you on this frequency every 6 hours until you reach De La Rey.
Do it recht, Mossy. We'll keep a 6-hour listening watch for you. Tot ziens.
They had abandoned their blankets when they fled before the fire, and tonight it was frosty. Sean and Claudia lay in each other's arms and whispered together softly.
I don't understand what you were saying on the radio. Who were you speaking with?
Claudia used the Americanism with, and Sean corrected it as he replied.
I was speaking to a South African military base, probably on the border where we are headed.
Will they give us assistance? She asked hopefully.
I don't know. They might. If I can contact someone I know. I've asked them to try, but they can't get hold of him.
Who?
During the Bush War, although I was in command of the Rhodesian scouts, I was also reporting to the South African military intelligence, he explained.
A spy? She asked.
No, he answered too quickly. The South Africans and the Rhodesians were allies, both on the same side. I'm a South African, so I was neither a spy nor a traitor.
A double agent, then? She teased him.
Call it whatever you like, but De La Rey was my South African control. Since the war, I've continued sending him reports from time to time, whenever I've been able to pick up pieces of information about ANC terrorist activity or sanctioneering moves by hostile governments, I'll pass it on to him.
He owes you, does he? She asked.
He owes me plenty. Besides which, we are related. He's a cousin, a first cousin on my grandmother's side.
Sean broke off as a small body insinuated itself between them.
Well, look who's here. If it isn't Minnie Mouse herself.
Claudia wriggled around to make room for the child, and Minnie settled down happily in the warm cradle formed by their bodies and pillowed her head on Sean's arm. He drew the child's body a little closer.
She's so cute. Claudia stroked the child's head. I could just eat her up.
They were silent for so long that Sean thought she had fallen asleep. But Claudia spoke again, softly and thoughtfully.
If we get out of here, do you think we could adopt Minnie?
The simple question was fraught with snares and pitfalls. It presupposed a life together thereafter, a settled existence with home and children and responsibilities, all the things that Sean had avoided over a lifetime. It should have startled him, but instead, it made him feel warm and comfortable. The portable Honda generator clattered noisily, and its light bulbs were strung on poles around the grounded helicopter. The engine hatches were open, and the debris suppressors had been removed from over the turbo intakes. The Portuguese engineer, in blue overalls, supervised and checked every task performed by his Russian prisoners. The Portuguese had very soon come to know and understand General China and to appreciate just how vulnerable was his own position. During the short time he had been with the RENAMO force, he had, on more than one occasion, been a witness to the punishment the General China dealt out to anyone who failed or offended him, and he was conscious now of those dark, fanatical eyes upon him as he worked. It was after midnight, but General China had not yet retired to rest. He had been flying all the previous day from first light to dusk, only landing to refuel the helicopter. A normal man would have been exhausted by now, certainly. The Portuguese pilot had slouched off to his tent many hours before. But General China was indefatigable. He prowled around the helicopter, watching every move, every action, asking questions, demanding haste, as restless as though he were possessed by some dark passion.
"You must have her ready to fly at dawn," he repeated, it seemed for the 100th time that night.
And then he went striding back to the open canvas-roofed shelter that he was using as his forward headquarters and pored over the large-scale map, studying once more his troop dispositions, brooding over them and muttering to himself. On the map, he had noted the features he had observed from the air, the location of the Frelimo logging camps and the rough roads they had hacked out of the forest. He had very soon realized the scope of the deforestation
and the numbers employed in the forced labour battalions. He had swiftly realised the futility of trying to find such a small party among such multitudes. He knew any sign of Sean's progress would have been obliterated by the intense activity in the area. He dared not send trackers or a pursuit into the logging area. He'd already lost almost 40 men in the Frelimo attack and the subsequent fire.
"No, I must be patient," he told himself.
He moved his hand down across the map. The Frelimo logging operation had not yet reached as far south as the hills that guarded the approaches to the Limpopo River basin. Between the hills and the river, the forest thinned out and gave way to open mopane veld. It was a strip 50 kilometres wide, good ground for tracking the fugitives, ground that they would be forced to traverse in order to reach the Limpopo and the border. General China had decided to set his final stop line there. All that day he had ferried in the fresh troops that Tipu Tip had placed at his disposal. In its rear cabin the Hind was able to carry 14 men in full field kit, and they had made 11 sorties. They had hopped over the forest, fully laden with assault troops, and landed them along the line of hills with orders to set up observation posts on each hill crest and to patrol the gaps between them. He now had almost 150 men in place to cut Sean Courtney off from the Limpopo.